I welcome you back from your meaningful discussion meetings, back to the droning harangue. Pay for your sins. Let's see, we've taken six steps. First, we admit we're powerless over alcohol. Our lives become management. There might be a power greater than ourselves. Somehow to restore us to living without alcohol. And we're in theory going to try to turn our lives over to that power, even though we don't see how it can be done. First major steps are taking an inventory and exposing ourselves with fear and trepidation, reading it to someone else, and then that big step of making a decision. Try to become willing to ask God to remove these defects of character, which brings us up now to step number 7, which is the shortest step of all the steps, only 7 words, but it has one of the great connotations, one of the most meaningful of the steps. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Just in passing, it's kind of a funny thing about alcoholics. Years ago, I remember going to a discussion meeting where they spent an hour discussing what's the difference between defects of character and shortcomings. What is which? And then later on I read in Bill's writings where he said he just didn't want to be redundant in the two consecutive sentences that mean the same thing. But we all like to argue, debate. We all like to find mystical things and very simple things. There's something here we don't see in it. They're keeping it from us. That's the theory of some of these philosophers I see now in transactional analysis and so on, in my opinion. Of course, I have no opinion on this. It's not anything to do with AA. But they make millions of dollars by having people think, the answer is just out of reach. Just come back again and you'll see. Buy literature and attend these hideous, and if you ever listen to them, they're just are meaningless. It's just, they just. But Alcoholics Anonymous isn't that way. Alcoholics Anonymous, Frank, no talking when you speak.
Sorry, sir.
If you must speak, it's okay to loudly say, isn't he wonderful, but let it go. Now we're going to take up humbly. Oh, I don't want to do that. Let's go on to the next step. But humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. We're going to now, we became willing, tried to become willing, ask God to help us become willing. Then we become willing to do that. And what we're doing, that is the first place, I think, in the steps, of course it is, where we get into what humility, humbly humility. And humility is always one of our goals. It's always a question. What is humility? Is it Uriah Heep? Is it somebody just standing there saying, oh, you ran over my shoe with your car. I hope I didn't hurt your tire. mix it up with humiliation. But it is little by little, I've come to believe that humility is a very, very, it's an effervescent thing. After you've been around a while, even when you got it, you don't know you got it. You only know you haven't got it when you haven't got it. It seems to me humility is that rare ability of somehow being able to be yourself and figure that's enough. Just being yourself, not having to have a front, not having to have an image, not having to have them think. And nobody can maintain that very long, I don't think. But we sometimes talk about newcomers coming to AA, and we say they're arrogant. We've got to tear down that wall and bring them to humility. And really, you'll discover it's the other way around. Because this pride they have is nearly always an overcompensation for feelings of inadequacy, of not being enough. But you build up over the years this wall of apparent ego and arrogance, and you can believe it sometimes yourself, that you really are superior, except when it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you gaze into the darkness and want to commit suicide. But when your rational powers are going strong, you can believe that, I really am, I'm too good for this stuff, I'm not. But it's been my experience that if you want to help people get humility, you build up their ego. You build up their self-worth. You have them take actions that build them up. Because as they build up, the compensatory wall comes down little by little. And little by little, you work yourself up to humility. You work yourself up to where you feel that what's inside of me is enough. I mean, not always very long you may think of that, but that's what I believe humility is. For just being me is enough. For I don't have to prove something or convince you or have an image or a facade. But of course humans can't live like that because part of living in the world is living with a facade where you don't show your emotions, as we talked about earlier, where when you're angry, you can't always afford to show anger, and you can't afford to show sorrow, and you can't afford to show a lot of things. You have to live behind a wall. But it's a nice few moments once in a while when you find that you can be yourself, that you don't have to have an agenda other than being yourself. And I think that's what refers to in this step, of course, as most of us know, Bill was so concerned about making sure that we did this as in an imploring method to diminish that wall of arrogance that, as the step was originally written, was written humbly on our knees, ask God to remove these defects of character, or these shortcomings. But then, in the editing before it went to press, they took out the phrase on our knees because they thought it might sound religious. And so they just humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. But that's what he wants us to do. Humbly, as ourself, putting down this wall of arrogance to live, to ask for some way to take up and remove these shortcomings. Now, as we talked about a little earlier this morning, there's no way, as human beings, you can't get rid of your shortcomings. You can't get rid of your defects of character all in one fell swoop. It'd be nice to do it. We're talking at lunch. Unfortunately, we're talking while we were eating, so I've lost a little something. I went to a different table. I didn't attend with my dinner companions. I went to a different table. We talked about it. There is a concept, and I know about it, and we were talking about the table, that cleaning up your defects of character is, you take care of them as they come up. You look at them as they come up. It's like clearing a cesspool for a septic tank. You take this out, which enables some more things to float up. Oh, Jesus. It's just an endless job. Pretty soon you want to go in the house. I think I'll get the rest of that next season or the season after that for sure. Which reminds me of something. This is no time to say it, but I know I'll forget it because other people and I in my room forget it. If anybody knows where there's a plunger around here, I could use it. I asked one of my office mates, bunk mates, to get one for me. He went to the desk up here and said, I'd like, and he forgot what he's asking for. He had to come back. And you have him defend you in court someday. See how that works out. Oh, I meant to say he's not guilty, Your Honor. I forgot. Well, he may like the penitentiary shift. Humbly ask God to remove these shortcomings, to little by little work on the things. And as Bill says in the 12 by 12, humility has not had an easy time of it in our society. And it really hasn't, because there's so many things there's so many emotions that we have to deal with, the negative things that humility is always kind of put down. Humility seems like kind of emotion. We believe in things like pride. Take pride in yourself. And all of us can work on pride, but most of us have come here with a great deal of pride and we've been destroyed by it. I suppose, but pride is, even on the walls of clubs sometimes they put down things you want to get rid of, despair and gluttony and lust and false pride. So it implies there must be some good pride somewhere. You never see a sign saying get rid of false lust, false hatred. Pride is sometimes, I think, confused because we equate it with self-worth. And I suppose in a sense it is. But pride, again, is something where we try to pull ourselves to be just a little bit more than we are, which I suppose is a very good thing. But humility is that rare occasion when we try to be just what we are. And if you are, it goes back to this again, if you know you're humble, then you're not humble. If you feel you have humility, you don't have it. It's something that comes when you don't even think about yourself. You see it in retrospect. Well, I had some humility. I was myself. I was thinking about others and not concerned with my image. So the seventh step really is not terribly complex. It's quite simple, but it's very difficult. Because I am now signing that agreement in principle I agreed to in the sixth step where I said, yeah, I'm going to agree in principle to sell it, and now, or to buy it. And now the seventh step, I'm going to put my name on there. I'm going to buy it. When I have people write an inventory, and I ask them to take their fifth, sixth, and seventh steps, one thing I always ask them to do, despite taking out the steps, I ask them to kneel in the bathroom or kneel in the kitchen or someplace where there's a hard surface and nobody can see them and ask God to help them truly become willing to remove these defects of character and the next day to do that same kneeling and ask Him to remove my shortcomings. I know no tongue of fire is going to come down and cleanse me, but I'm going to become willing to take that crap as it comes to the surface and at least give it a try. And a lot of it I may not be able to get in the first swing, but I'll get it little by little. And I got to be willing to do it. That's, I think that's what they mean when they say, as the years go along, the road gets narrower. It really gets more comfortable, but you're picking up more crap and throwing it aside. You're able to, at last I'm able to get rid of this thing. And at last I'm able to get rid of this thing. I see how meaningless and how painful this has been, and I thought it was bringing me happiness. That's over a period of time we do that. Then we get to the end of that step, and we've made a decision to and decided to ask God to remove these defects of character. And you get to a couple of the steps that I think are really the most gratifying of all the steps, although sometimes they're very difficult. And that is the eighth step, of course, the eighth and ninth step, the eighth step where we have to make a list of all persons we have harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And that is easy for some. I mean, yes, there are some people here that I've hurt. And I don't mind saying I'm sorry to them. But there's a lot of other people who've hurt me worse than I hurt them. Where's the step where somebody makes an amend to me? Where's the step where something does right for me? When some of these people, they've ruined my life, some of them, seems to me. They've just done terrible things. There's an interesting concept in dealing with the eighth step and how you deal with all of these things where people have hurt you and you have to decide which ones you have to make an amend to. And I think it sounds difficult on the surface, but what a remarkable help it is if you can do it. And that is, you go into it by saying, I'm going to start off by forgiving everybody who has hurt me. I'm going to forgive everybody who's hurt me. They're all forgiven. And you can do that to a point, easily, except for four or five people that we're still going to get. And some of these things they've done are unforgivable, and I can't be expected to forgive those. But you've got to try to be able, little by little, to forgive everybody. Then you can look at the list consciously and say, I have to make a list of people I've hurt. Now, the question is, what do you mean by hurt? To me, that has always meant they have felt worse as the result of me. financially, emotionally, spiritually, anyway. If I have made them feel worse, I have hurt them. And they must certainly be brought up for review. I think one of the good things about taking an eighth step with a sponsor, for example, is many times a sponsor can look at it dispassionately and say, what seems to be an amend that you need to make here is not really an amend you need to make. What seems to be a justified resentment is the one you have to make. It's always been my experience in making up this list of people that one group nearly always goes out there. And they are the group from the fourth step of people I resent. Nearly everybody I resent, I feel guilty towards in some way, I discovered later. Through one way or another, one of the reasons I maintain that resentment is I think as good an example of that is in everything I've done with people who take an inventory. Now, it isn't always the case, but nearly always. That's the only thing I ever ask them to save out of their inventory. Take the rest of it and burn it. But take the resentments, and we'll talk about that later. The resentments should at least be very carefully analyzed. Despite what they have done to me, what have I done to them? Because as we said this morning, people aren't really against me. They are for themselves. And I'm interfering with that. Just as I am not against people, only if they interfere with me, with what I want or what I desire, or as I perceive them doing something to hinder my wants. Are you going to make a list of people you've harmed? We all, it's very quite simple. And the reason to do this is not to become good, but because we get tired of living in disharmony. When you're living with continual ongoing resentments and feelings, and there's always disharmony, of course. So you're going to try to find some form of harmony. So you make a list, and you I know on my list of my eighth step, the one of the things I didn't have in my fourth step, I had my resentments, my sponsor made it, was my father. And my father, I always felt, had partially ruined my life when I was a boy. He had left my mother and I, he'd married another lady, and I'd never seen a divorce before that. I lived such an insulated life. And not only that, but he always wanted to make demands of me. He always wanted me to do more than I was doing. I had all sorts of reasons why he ruined my life. Partially. It was one of the reasons I could always feel victimized. That's incidentally, one of the things that very cunning and baffling and powerful about this list. Sometimes you have to put people on there who you feel have victimized you, because you'll never get rid of the victimization unless you find a way out of this, in my opinion. But my sponsor said, why don't you put him on your list? I said, because he has hurt me much worse than I've ever hurt him. He said, the point is that whatever he did, you were a rotten son. You were not a good son. He may have hurt you first, but he may have had reasons for doing that, but you had no reasons to punish him. I hadn't talked to my father for 10 years when I wrote this list. And I never was going to talk to him again, if I could help it. So I thought he was he made me put that down. He made me put down employers that had screwed me around, that I had to go back. One of the things that put on the list that's kind of strange is, there are people I have hurt who I can't make amends to. I can't make amends to my grandmother. She's dead. Can't make amends to an old guy that lived down the street who I hurt badly. Not really badly, but hurt badly is what bothered me. And I can't. But you put them all down. Kind of a long list after a while. And you must. Then you at least, in theory, are willing to make amends to them all. It's not a matter of some spiritual fervor. It's a matter of making amends to them. And that really, there isn't anything mysterious about the eighth step. You put down things, the people you resent, the people you've hurt, all these things. And we all know that. I mean, there's nothing in a step seminar, all of us are knowledgeable enough. That's all there is to it. There's nothing spooky or miracle or miraculous about it. In the ninth step, we try to make these amends. And usually it's nice to have the help of someone, like a sponsor, to see what is meaningful and what isn't. Some of the difficult amends are, for example, not difficult, but I mean they're mechanical, but they're still a little difficult. It's like amounts of money that you can't pay. To call up that collection agency and tell them where you are and what your real name is. Because I've never had to deal with that. I've often thought, well, I've used as one of the examples why drinking was so good. I remember once upon a time in El Paso, living in El Paso, Texas, the household finance, who's the friend of every alcoholic, I just done another consolidation loan, which buries you deeper. There's never any way out of those. And they were, I was unable to make the payments for a while because money had to be spent for other reasons, for my indulgence. And my wife and I were waiting around the house for them to call. There was some talk about they were going to repossess some furniture. And we had little kids. And I was trying to hold a job. This would not look good for this executive to have his furniture repossessed. And when we were waiting for the phone to ring, my wife was just, and I was, and I happened to think I had brought home some rum. One thing about living in El Paso, across the river in Juarez, you can get rum cheap, and it's good rum. That's where the term rummy comes from. You, after a while, you just kind of, you don't have to drink much anymore, you just kind of stay there. But I went and got some rum, and I offered my wife a drink. I tried to be pleasant. I said, do you want a drink? She gave me that same intolerant, nastiest, fuck you! Think you want to be like you? Children. I did a couple drinks of rum, and by the time the phone rang, I was the only one in the house who didn't have any compunctions about answering it. Listen, you keep up this crap, we're not going to borrow for you anymore. Now stop calling me, goddammit. But now I'm sober, I don't have that way to go. Hello, I'm working 12 golden steps for recovery. Will that work as payments? No, it won't. So if you're willing to go to people and say, I'll pay you $5 a week. And they say, that isn't very much. But if that's all you got, we'll take it. I've never heard anybody send the $5 back. And make amends to people that sometimes it's very difficult because they don't. If you'd like to make amends and have them say, you're so wonderful. You've come here and made amends. You're just wonderful. And sometimes they don't do that. I went all the way back to Dallas to a big advertising agency. And I made an amends to a guy. I went to see him. And I said, I came here. I had a hard time getting in to see him. I'd been one of his better men at one time, I thought. Now I want you in. I make it. I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to make amends for the problems that I gave you here. Well, what are you doing in Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, I guess I'm an alcoholic. He said, I never thought you were an alcoholic. I said, well, why do you think I did these things? You know, this TV with company, truck and wrecking it, and little things. He said, I thought you were a son of a bitch, and I still do. And I almost had a new amend to make. I'm going to punch him in the face. Then I did. I walked out. You make amends like that, and it's, I remember my making
making amends to my father. Oh, my sponsor said, write him a letter, tell him you're sorry you're a bad son, and you hope, you wish him well. And I wrote, said, and he did something I learned from, and I've done it ever since. He said, let me read it before you send it. And I read it and said, no, 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 that's a revenge letter. Do it over. And so I did it over. Finally, he accepted it. I sent it. And I got no, very little response. I don't think I got, I guess I didn't get the response from my father. He said, well, send him another letter and ask him if he got the first letter. And you just see this tall, strong, imposing, frightening man take my letter and ripping it up. I thought, that son of a bitch. I'll write him another letter. I'll tell him if let me see it. So he sent another, and he wrote me back a letter. He said, yes, I got your letter. I didn't know what to make of it for his son because it sounded so unlike you. I thought maybe you were drunk. But he said, I hope you're doing well. I know he's rather upset, but I hope you're doing well. I thought, well, that isn't very, that's nice, but it isn't much to show for the years he hurt me. And a couple years later, or a year later, my sponsor made me send him birthday cards and Christmas cards. And a year later, I had to go to Minneapolis for a convention where I was working. About 2.5 years sober then. I was working at this big medical corporation. And I lived 90 miles away from there, so I made arrangements to go down and see my father. I said, I'm going to come down and see you. And I just, oh, it was difficult. I went down there, and there's this house. And I didn't like his wife. I hated her. This tall, imposing, threatening guy. I banged the doorbell, knocked the door. The door opened, and there's no tall, threatening, imposing guy. There's a short, little guy. Oh, son, how are you? So glad you're feeling better. I said, what happened to that big guy that used to push me around? I don't know. But anyway, I wasn't thrilled with my father, but at least we talked. We sat and talked. And from then on, we talked a little bit more, and I, after a while, I made a point. My father suggested this, and I do it to people too. Treat him like I was a good son, whatever I think. Just act like a good son from now on. And there never was a week after that I didn't call him. Didn't have much to say sometimes. Whenever I got in that area, I stopped in and saw him. Didn't like his wife very well, but she died early, so that helped. Yeah, did a break here and there, what the hell, he kept fighting. I came home and was a source of strength to him at her funeral. Got him through that. And we got to be quite close, actually. In fact, in declining years, she lived in our house. And we were closer than most fathers and sons I ever knew. And when he went back to Wisconsin, because he got lonely for his old friends and old fools that he was associated with, an old Norwegian, an old Norwegian church, that when he died, I was holding his hand, and he gave my hand a little squeeze and died. That's just a nice, nice, wonderful thing, isn't it? But it all because I made an inventory to sell, I made an amend to someone who didn't deserve it. If I wouldn't have been forced to make that amend, I wouldn't have made that in 10,000 years of myself. Then they talk about making amends to, how do you make an amend to, how do I make an amend to my grandmother, who was dead for 10 years by the time I started making amends? And for taking her money, the little money she had, and said I needed some money bad to get some to drink, and treating her with apparent love, but always trying to worry how I could hustle her for something. And my sponsor gave me an assignment on that, which I've in turn given to many people. You have to spend a lot of time from then on. You got to look for little old ladies or having a difficult time somewhere as you go around your rounds, and stop and help them. Again and again. Up some old silly lady out of the store with her bags. Here, can I give you a hand? Can I give you a ride? Can I do something for you? People I know, some people I don't know. I think of that in theory of making an amend to the world for what I've done to a lady I can't make an amend to. So I make an amend to somebody else like her on a continuing basis. I've done that with old men and old women and sponsors and all sorts of things. I make a special point of going out of my way to being of some sort of help for them to make an amend because I can't make the amend I should make, so I make it to the world in her name. In other words, I made a donation in my grandmother's name to that old lady, or that old man, or that old situation. There's all sorts of amends you can make. Now, to me, one of the great realizations of amends, the great goal of amends. I have never made a sincere amend to anybody that I ever really hated afterwards. I've made a lot of amends to people I've hated. And I was forced to do it. But after making those amends, I didn't hate them anymore. I didn't always like them, but I never brooded about them anymore. I never hated them. It's the funniest thing in the world. Me making an amend to them enables me to stop hating them. It's one of the strangest phenomena in all of AA that I know. And so we go around making amends. Sometimes as you go along, you find amends 2 years later that I had never thought about. Think, I should do that. To stop and take the time to set things right as you can. I don't know, as I said this morning, at the end of the fifth step and the end of this ninth step, I think are the two great apparent moments of gratification of all the steps. They all have kind of a spiritual growth, but at the end of the fifth step, there's a feeling of well-being, and there's a great feeling of well-being at the end of the ninth step, because they both consist of doing something outside of myself and adding to the harmony of my existence. And I think it is not a surprise that at the end of the ninth step is where Bill Wilson has put the promises in the book, where it talks about if you do these things, because these are the six steps, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, the six steps where we try to clean up this crap that we agreed to do in the third step without knowing what we had to do. And before we get into the things that we do on a continuing basis, these are cleaning up the cesspool and sweeping up the crap and dreadful little crappy jobs, but that begin to get the baggage out of the way. We talk about our life wanting to be one day at a time. It's kind of hard to live one day at a time when you're carrying 1972 with you too. And the fall of 1974 is what that guy said to me in 1966. Somehow these things ought to be cleared away so I can at least face today with today. And you can't always do it perfectly. Again and again, I just always try to stress to people that remember, we can't ever do it perfectly. And the irony of it is, the great fault of alcoholics is that they're perfectionists. Anything worth doing is worth doing to excess. First law. If it isn't perfect, why? They talk about alcoholics being perfectionists. I didn't used to identify that. I've never been a perfectionist. I just want things to be right, and if not, screw it. And it's a long thing to discover that we are not going to do things perfectly, and we can't do it wonderfully. There's something in the 12 and 12 that's kind of funny about talking about spirituality, where it says we should never be satisfied with our spiritual condition. We should rest in our spiritual condition. Which gets back to that same old phenomenon in the book that sounds strange until you begin to realize what it means. The good is the enemy of the best. we stop halfway. As soon as the heat is reduced a little bit, we just, because we're by nature easy weighers, and we stop a little bit. And it requires some use of a power greater than myself, of a God, if you will, that power to continue to do it. God works. An example that I like is that when you're going to make an amend to someone that intimidates you and frightens you, I can see it now in retrospect. I wish I'd known at the time, but I can help other people with it sometimes. Whether you're going to make a place where they used to work, and you're going to see this guy's office, and he's waiting for you, you know, he's going to grind you. You're going to go in there and say you're sorry. I'll tell you an example of that. When I was a senior at the University of Wisconsin, I was in the first class after the war started in 1946, and we were steely-eyed, sex-crazed veterans. That's our image. And we were wild and did a lot of things because we were scarred by the war. We played that to the hilt, I'll tell you. And I was on probation several times, but I'd won some trophies for the college. And when I was a senior, one night I was downtown drinking, and I ran into this traveling sales lady with a magazine firm. I told her about the trophies I'd won, and she didn't seem to believe it. So we went out to the university. I kicked open the door to the administration building. And I went in and showed her the trophies. And I was kind of drinking too much. I don't recall exactly what happened, but apparently I felt she had a flat tire because I was pumping her up there on the floor. When some policemen came in and illuminated this gory scene. I'll tell you something. If you ever want a quick cessation of sexual drive, you have a Fleekman flashlight. Quick detox. And in 1950, of course, they were a little less free in social custom than they are now. So they took us to jail. I was put in jail, and so was she. And the next morning, she went to court and got a $150 fine for disorderly conduct and a floater out of town. And I was held over the next day. And the next day, I got two things. Just before I went to court, I got a letter from the university saying, from the dean of students, "Note, this is your note of expulsion. You were expelled." And then he wrote, had written in a hand letter, "I worked time after time to protect you. All you had to do was go two more months. And I begged you to take care of yourself. I told you not to drink it off and nonsense. You would not do it. You've broken your parents' heart. You've broken my heart. You've made me look a fool at this university. You made it look bad. It's all over the papers. We could file suit against you for breaking and entering in the nighttime to commit a felony, to wit, adultery. But we're not going to do that. Just stay away from this campus forever." Now, we'll jump ahead a few years. That was not an easy amend to go make, I'll tell you. He'd become president of the university by this time. And at the same time I went to see my dad, I also went down there to see him. He would not see me. He told the secretary, I heard him say, "I'm not in, and tell him I'll never be in to him." Well, that kind of cuts into your spiritual fervor, I'll tell you. I wonder why they say, "Oh yeah, are you into that? I'm here to tell you about God, you son of a bitch." But I came by the next time I was home. Funny, I call it home, and you always still think of it as home. I didn't live there all that long. But finally, after about 3 years of this, I called him on the phone and he agreed from California. He said, "I'll be in Eau Claire. I wish you'd give me a chance to come and see you. I mean, you got something to say." "No, I don't want anything to come see you." "Oh, all right." Because he was a very religious man. He was disappointed in me. He always had great hopes for me. And so when I went to his office, I was literally sweating. I just God, I just... And the technique I know now, I didn't know then. But I'd recommend anybody in that situation. Go across the hall. Go in the washroom. Stop for a minute. Remember that you're not going in there alone. You have God in your pocket. We are going in there. You can't be all that bad if we are going in there. But I didn't know it then. So I went in. I told him what I tried to do, and I was working in radio and television in Hollywood by this time, and it looked like my wife and children were going to move back with me eventually, and I was very sorry. I know it caused a great deal of problems. That's very interesting. I wish you well. Thank you very much. I'm busy now. And that was the end of that event. Well, next time I was back, 8 months later, I went down same again. God, poor bastard. I'm sure he felt like a fawn in the forest fire. Every time he looks up, here comes this fool making amends again.
Just leave me alone. I forgive you, Jesus.
But that was really hurting me. That had left a real scar. And I talked to him at length. And then the next time I came back, I didn't come back to make an amend, but I said, God, just talk to you about something. I have an idea. He said, I'm really busy. This was 6 months later. I said, you know, if it isn't too much, I know it's a terrible thing to ask you. We were now in the 1960s. I said, but would it be possible for me to get the alumni news bulletin? I know technically I'm not an alumnus, but just because I really have a deep feeling towards the school. Oh, all right. He said, send me that. And I said, I saw him for most of the while. I saw most of the points that. Now we jump ahead to 1976. I'd seen him several times. I had gone back to speak at the annual dinner in my hometown of Eau Claire. They had it started off, they called it the Eau Claire Annual Coon Feed. And I was back there at the 10th annual Coon Feed. I looked forward to that with a lot of anticipation. They gave you beef, but you know they called it because it started off with coon some years before. And you know when they changed the name of it? About 2 years after that, after I was there, they had a lawyer from Chicago, a black lawyer, came up and spoke. And he started off by saying, "I don't know if you want me to talk if you're going to eat me." I went up there and spoke, and he was invited. He'd never been to an AA meeting, and they'd invited. It's kind of funny, they invited the chief of police. Part of my talk, they'd be able to say, I was one of his first arrests when he was a rookie. There's a feeling of continuity in that way, you know. I'll tell you something funny to you that may give you some hope if you're still going through any problem that I've discovered over the years. If you turn out well, all of those early things become amusing little legends. Remember that time? Oh, gosh. If you turn out badly, they're proof you always were a no good son of a bitch. It just depends on how you turn up. Because I go back and people chuckle and laugh about things 30 years ago, they wouldn't even talk to me on the street because of those same things. Now remember that time? Put their arms on you, feel like you get your hands off me. Now, maybe there's some end to this story, hopefully. I've incidentally been, I spoke at the 20th annual banquet, the 25th annual banquet. And next year I'm going to speak at the 30th annual banquet. It's just wonderful. Just a local boy makes good rotten, drunken puke for the first water. But anyway, 1978, I get a call from the University of Wisconsin from the dean, secretary. She says, we're having a big alumni get-together scheduled in Los Angeles for the alumni who live in that area. And the guy that was in charge of it has disappeared. We don't know where he went. But we have no arrangements, no accommodations, and it's supposed to be in 2 weeks. And the dean thought, since you're
kind of an operator. Me? Look at the holes in my palms. And can you get us some? I said, sure I can. I got friends. I got him the Biltmore Hotel. Lovely room in the Biltmore. Call the message, it's all set. Just tell them to come. And they were enthused. You did such a good job in this. Would you like to join us? I said, yes, I would. So I came and mixed with all these old alumni fools, and I'm glad to see all the members of my class look much older than I did. To me, they did. And the dean was there, this now president. He said, why? I can't, you know, you couldn't see me several times, but I understand you're really doing pretty good. Said, what are you doing now? He said, I understand you're running some kind of a thing on Skid Row. I said, yeah, I am. He said, well, that's not like you, is it? To look out for anybody else, what's in it for you? I said, well, just doing it. He said, I'd like to come over and see it. I said, okay. So after the thing, we went over to the Skid Row. It was on Sunday afternoon. We walked up through this clean, sparkling place. One of the few missions in the world that doesn't smell like disinfectant in urine. It's clean and sparkling, but deals with just dying men and women. And he saw the whole thing, all staffed by people who used to be classified hopeless people on the street. And he couldn't believe it. He said, I can't believe it. I know it's true, there's your name on your desk, but you've really changed a little bit, haven't you? Well, I hope so, Prez. I felt just like I was back in being intimidated again. I hadn't felt that way in years. You know? I thought, sorry. So that, he said, oh, well, that touched me pretty much. That was the end of that. Now, we jump ahead a year. January 1980. Get a call from the University of Wisconsin. Well, this is Miss Coxon from the alumni office. President is retiring this year, you know. He's retiring from his job. I said, oh, that nice man, glad, wish him well, but I can do that. You want me to contribute towards his going away, President? What is it you want me to do? He said, no. It's a strange thing. He has recommended that you be named our Alumnus of the Year and come and speak at our commencement. I said, wow. Okay, I said, that's wonderful. She said, okay, what's that? She sent me all the data. So in 1980, May, I was the Distinguished Alumnus of the Year of the University of Wisconsin. And I brought all my children with me. And my parents were still alive. They were very old. They died soon thereafter. But my mother and my father, who hadn't lived together for many years, but they came together. And my kids were all there. And I spoke at the commencement on the benefits of living a decent life. And I didn't want them to know that I had been expelled. We laughed about it later. I must be the only alumnus, the same alumnus in the history of the world, that was expelled from the institution. Didn't even graduate. Just, get out of here, you son of a bitch! You know. That was really a touching moment. My parents cried. They cried when I got expelled, and they cried when I was the alumnus of the year. My children cried. I cried. I had a chance, as I told them, they didn't quite understand what I was talking about, but I said, I've made amends for many things in my life, but this is one area I've never had a chance to make amends for. I want to make amends to this university. So after that, I got thinking about that a year later or so. I thought, I started writing funny little letters to the new dean and president. You know, really appreciate this opportunity, but isn't it kind of bad to have a non-graduate to be your alumnus of the year? And I did it in a joking way, but I kept grinding. 1986. They said, okay, and sent me a diploma. So now I'm a member of the class of 1986. I by far look the oldest of anyone in that class. But again, that's a long, tedious story. But again, that's an amend I never would have made. I would have been ashamed to go back and face that old guy, and the first time he saw me, I never would have gone back. I'll tell you that. I don't mean that every time you go back and make an amend, you're going to be an alumnus of the year, or you're going to get close to your father, but I'm sure that good things can happen. And if nothing else happens, you will lose the hatred for those people. You will lose the terrible separation. You, in a sense, take on, you lose your sense of isolation. You rejoin much of the human race, which is really what that step's about. And I think it's most appropriate. I know you've all heard this 100 times, but in that context, exactly what it says. He goes into it by saying we should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. Then, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That is one of the great lines of all of AA. The very things that have made us guilty and terrible now are tools to help somebody else. You say you've been in the insane asylum? I have too. I'll follow you. The first guy I sponsored that stayed sober, I tried to sponsor several people, but I increased their drinking as far as I could tell. But this first guy, my 2 years sober, he's at his first meeting. He comes to me afterwards and said, I'd like you to be my sponsor. That's sure. And he became my sponsor. I became his sponsor. He stayed sober. Later, he told me why he wanted me to be his sponsor. Why do you think? Because he didn't have any front teeth, and I didn't have any front teeth. And I was sober 2 years without front teeth, and he realized it's not necessary to have front teeth. He understands. You might say, you may wonder how long I went without front teeth. I should describe that. When I was 2 years sober, I got this job in the medical corporation. And I said to my sponsor, well, I've got some money put aside now. I'm going to be an executive. I'm going to be a writer in the advertising department. I'm going to get some front teeth. He said, for Christ's sake, send that money to your kids in Dallas. They have so little. I said, send them money every chance I get. He said, you didn't have to send them enough. You got enough to buy front teeth. I said, Jesus, Bob. They all got front teeth. I'll show you their picture. Something to do with front teeth, something to do with your attitude. You're a selfish thing. Send them the goddamn money. So I send them the money. With graciousness and love, of course. I wasn't mad at them, I was mad at that old fool. I learned to carry my lip like this. So I don't think anybody in that company ever knew I didn't have front teeth. I guess they thought I was burned in a fire, you know. But I went to work every day and I did the things and eventually I got some front teeth. Now I tell newcomers that, I may have said, maybe the provincial, I don't know if I did not. I lost my teeth now. Like our book says, we're like men who have lost their front teeth. We never grow new ones. But I often tell them, if you're concerned about losing teeth, let me give you some hope. Once you become like me, spiritually transformed and almost holy, they grow back. They go.
Have your sponsor tell you about that, otherwise.
No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Most of the time. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Now these are not, we all see these things, we've all had these things happen. What's miraculous about these 12 promises, because when Bill wrote them, many of them hadn't happened to him yet. You know,
You can find self-help books, with all sorts of things. Well, you become happy and secure, so secure, and you know you're never going to do that. But he wrote a set of promises in here. One of the reasons I think this is divine, that he did not know could, hadn't even happened to him, and anybody's been sober very long has had it happen to them. They don't stay there, but they come and go because we're human beings. You know, almost after I was sober a few years, the closest I came to doubting the promises, I was 5.5 years sober, and my wife and children moved out to California. And I was so eager to make my children feel good and secure that I overspent and reached a deep financial trouble. And I called up my sponsor. I don't know, I had front teeth. Chuck? I said, no. I was kind of joking, but I half serious. I said, you know, I've really done very well. I've been 5 years sober and things are, Chuck, you know, I wonder, you know, if this financial insecurity will leave me. And I tell you, I've had financial insecurity like this for, maybe the promises can't come true for people like this. He said, no, son, you've got it wrong. He said, fear of financial insecurity will leave you. You can be financially secure all the time, but just don't be afraid of it. I said, I think I hear the door. That's true. All of these promises come true to us. Anybody that's been sober any length of time has made a rudimentary attempt to work the steps. You may not even be aware of it, but we will intuitively know how to handle things. Every day we handle things that used to baffle us. Just fact of living in the world and being of service to others. And self-seeking does slip. We have other thoughts than what's in it for me on a continuing basis, because we've been forced to do it here and trapped into it. But that's why the 8th and 9th step is the final cleanup of that. It gets us out of isolation. It gets us making use of the tools. It gets us back into the world around us, really. So, it really boils down to two major categories so far of steps. One, where we're going to identify it. I'm a drinker. I can't stay sober. And there's a power here. And some kind of power will change it. And then the action steps, where I have to do things that I don't want to do. And that is really where I have to ask God's power to help me, because of myself, I will quit. But write that inventory and make those amends, even when they're not worthy of it. And make the rest of the inventory and share that inventory with a human being and with God and myself. Get it out of my head. And then become willing to have God remove defects of character that I want to hang on to because they seem necessary to me. But I've got to be willing to get rid of them if they come up and when I can. And then humbly ask Him to remove these shortcomings. And then make a list of persons, the carnage I've caused behind me without being aware of it. A lot of people like me say, well, I just damaged myself, really. I've left a wake of carnage behind me I never meant to, because I'm convinced all I've ever wanted to be is a good man in a good world. And things get out of control. And then make those amends. And then I can at least walk with some degree of dignity and begin to take care of the maintenance steps that come up next. So I think that the 7th step and the 6th step are critically important. I think the 4th and 5th steps are. I certainly think the 8th and 9th steps are. These action steps are the ones that do it. Where they take us from being victims into being masters of our fate with some degree of dignity. And when we're done with them, we're very glad we've taken them. Thank you. Discussion time. If you want to talk, make an observation, ask a question, ask me what's wrong with me.
Doug, my name is Clem Kemmerer.
Hi, Doug.
There's a paragraph in step 7. I'm a little confused by what you said about building up a recovering alcoholic self-worth. The paragraph says it's irrelevant. It is only by repeated humiliations that we achieve a measure of humility.
No, it isn't. It doesn't say only by repeated humiliation. It says it is by, I think it's to something the fact that repeated humiliations can bring humility. Let me see. I know where it is too. I think. Where the hell is it? They moved it. They. Don't you know who they are? How long have you been in AA? Well, I know just the sentence you're saying. That's what I say. Yeah, I'm going to read the sentence.
But I think it suggests that as a last resource, if people don't want to speak to religion.
Well, anyway, here. There's a phrase that talks about humiliation. You can find it when I talk about it going back to Phil. Going to my song and dance. I am not questioning the fact that humiliation brings this. But humility and humiliation are two different things. Humiliation are some of the things that drive us to have to seek the things we find in humility. But I don't think that's the only way to get to humility, because humility, as I say, in my opinion, and I believe it to be true, I don't think any... What does it say? It says, you're right, it was only by... You were right. It was only by repeated humiliations that we were forced to learn something about humility. For us, the process of getting a new perspective was unbelievably painful. I believe that's true, is what he says. But I also know that it's not a contradiction in terms, because these humiliations give you the pain that make you take the actions to build up your ego. In other words, what we're saying is, I want to build up my self-worth so I don't have to have overcompensating apparent arrogance and ego. Do you know what I'm saying at all?
Yeah, but it's his... That's the trip. Ego deflates the trip.
That's right. The bad ego, the outside ego. But I'm talking about self-worth, not ego. You build up your self-worth, and that diminishes the phony ego. You understand that difference? Because I'm not saying that... Yeah, it's ego deflation in depth, but it's the ego of the false ego, the... Yes, I'm all right. I'm fine. Don't look inside and see that there's a weak little guy trying to move the arms and legs and say, I'm all right. In my experience, you build up self-worth to lower the ego.
Yeah, thank you very much. Clancy, doesn't it also say that the basic ingredient of all humility is the desire to seek and do God's will?
Yes, it does say that. Of course, what God's will is a metaphysical conundrum. Yeah. God, I'll tell you, talking about God's will, and we should bring up the 11th step. But who's the guy that wrote Seventh Story Mountain? Thomas Merton. Spent 18 years in the Gethsemane Monastery in Gethsemane, Kentucky. We all know it, hopefully. He went in there because he wanted to study to find God's will for him. He was in a non-speaking, self-abasing monastery. That's a tough monastery. And he came out of that monastery after 18 years, back into the world, and he wrote a prayer that's on my wall. And it said, Dear God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me. And the fact that I think I'm following your will does not mean that I'm actually doing so. But I do believe this. I believe the desire to please you does, in fact, please you. I hope I never do anything apart from that desire. Because I know if you'll do this, you'll never leave me in the shadow of death or to face my troubles all alone. Now, if a guy who spent 18 years in silent meditation on a daily basis trying to study God's will, if he can't find out, there's not much... chance I'm going to find out before supper time. That's why God's will is kind of an ethereal thing. It's an intuitive thing, but it's something dramatic. That's why Bill says in our literature again and again, it's good to check it with somebody else to make sure that it's not obsession.
Because if I think about anything long enough that I want, it becomes God's will. So to do God's will is, as far as I'm concerned, is to take the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the closest thing I know to God's will. And that's how we maintain humility, is by taking these actions that keep us out of becoming, having to be something we're not, to prove, to make up for our deficiency. Yes, ma'am.
You said something last night, it was so nice that everything you said, I think it's correct, that humility is not humility of being humble, it's accepting the fact that somebody else knows what's best for you, because God or another person. And I said it's something else as being teachable.
Yeah. I don't think I said that's what being humble was. I said, but that's what you have to do here. And maybe I said it was humble. I'll have to check the tapes. But I don't think so. But I mean, I would not take exception to that statement. I wouldn't mind making that statement. That becoming, accepting the fact that someone, that I am not the top of the chain. Whether it be sponsor or God or whoever. And I, if you're careful, when I'm taking my direct authorization from God, because I have a tendency to change those a little bit, so I want to check with people around me. But I think that's certainly true. I would have no objection to that at all. I think these cleanup steps are really so gratifying, and yet we all fight against them because they're absolute opposite of what my intelligence would tell me would be effective for those symptoms. Yes, ma'am.
In talking about the ninth step, you need to go into
when to do so. They're quite clear about that, the 12 and 12. And in the big book, where you, I think the test you give yourself, will everyone feel better as a result of this amend? You know, I see guys, I want to make a clean breast of things, so I went to my wife. And I said, I've been screwing the neighbor for 28 years. And you know, she wouldn't accept that amend. No, she won't. Will you accept the subpoena tomorrow? I think that's what the examples in the book where it talks about that. But I've actually had guys tell me that I sponsor. I could just punch him in the face. Well, just talk to me about that before you did it. And I'll go do God's will. Try living alone. That's God's will for you for the next couple of years. But I think that it's a relatively easy litmus test on that, is that you, will it make everybody involved not feel worse? That's what all it boils down to. I mean, it's quite simple, really. We can talk phrases and inner meanings, but that's the basic sense. Will everybody feel better? Yes, Jack.
Somewhere in the book, I don't know where, it says, the first to be such as ourselves, to be a maximum unity.
Yes. That's true. Well, okay. The major purpose of these steps is to enable us to be of maximum use to God and to our fellows. I've got to make light of it, but that really says it all, Jack. That really explains it. You know, I come so close hour after hour, just they put them there just to see if I'm alert. It's the thing that, you know, Dr. Bob, to synthesize it all of it, Bob, when he was dying, giving that talk in the First International Convention. And he said, first, glad to be here, of course, and said, our program, when boiled down to the end, just means this. It means love and service. We all know what love is, and we all know what service is. If you want scientific things, leave it to the scientists. We are to be of service and to give a hand to the man behind us. And all of these steps are enable us to do that. And the reason that they have to be kind of hard is because we are caught up with self-will people who have used alcohol to anesthetize the results of their actions, and now they've lost the anesthesia and have to live with the pain of them without any way to cope. And what we're getting is a way to cope.